strong connection to the prior orthogonal decomposition?
I mean, you didn't require that your different environment bases were all orthogonal bases, because as you said, it's only the collection of environment states that.
The trier orthogonal decomposition theorem is a special case.
Okay, it is. All right. So it is true then that there are quantum states that just won't satisfy the antecedent of your inference, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, the vast majority of states in Hilbert space do not. Right. Most states are thermal. Thermal states don't have redundant information in them.
When you say most states are thermal, usually I think of a thermal state as a mixed state, but you mean a purification of a thermal state? Your criterion applies for pure states.
Yeah, so I mean most according to the Haar measure. And when I say thermal, I mean that all of the subsystems that are less than half the size of the lattice are pure states.
Because the
grand production rate is just going to be like basically given by the Lyapunov exponents in the system, or some subset of them. It might end up being something like the Kolmogorov Sinai entropy, which is more or less constructive of the Lyapunov exponents. It's just like a chaotic system is just like something that is performing a Sturm-Gerlach experiment at a regular rate. And so the total number of outcomes is going exponential.
So in circumstances where you have a quantum state that doesn't redundantly encode information about the system and its environment, maybe I've just built a big quantum computer and I run some quantum algorithm, for example, and it just doesn't have one of these decompositions.
Yeah. I would just say you just have some big quantum state. It doesn't have classical branch structure.
Okay. So, but you still have a prescription for defining the Biebles. It's just that for those states, the Biebles will be rather trivial. If I say let's go looking for which observables are redundantly encoded, what comes back? Identity.
Yes.
Identity is redundantly encoded. Now, are you concerned that, like in the context of many realist interpretations, people wheel out examples like this to show that in certain circumstances your ontology becomes trivial and it can no longer support, we can't really believe that what's going on in my quantum computer, if the ontology is fundamental, that it's all trivial, it's all identity for a bunch of time, because there's something non-trivial happening there. Sort of, how do you respond to that kind of?
My concern is not with ontology at all. It is literally, how do I describe what measurements are, measurement outcomes are unambiguously, mathematically precise? I'm happy to call them, if I have a few beers, maybe I'll start thinking about whether the wave function is real or not real, that sort of stuff. But the purpose of this is just to give a precise definition to branches, regardless of whether that is satisfying as a complete ontology. I really don't think about them as Biebles, if that makes sense. I just think about them as the things on about which we can reason classically.
That last statement seems surprising. You just gave a talk where you said, "I recommend that the Biebel structure you should assume is branching structure."
Every single slide.
Yeah, if we keep having this conversation. I'm confused. Like it sounded to me like you were endorsing branching structure as Biebels, and yet you just seem to say I don't think of them as Biebels. So I'm confused.
I think they are preferred Biebels.
You can define a set of Biebels without claiming that
they exist. So that's what you're saying, that you think that they're in the circumstances I just described, where the ontology that we would get from branching structure is somewhat trivial. Would you say, oh, there's some other ontology and I haven't specified what that is? All I'm saying is that, we need at least this much ontology and there might be more. Is that your...
I would say that So I am generally not an ontology guy, not because I don't think it's important, but because I don't feel like I have any special skills at it, and I don't feel like I can make progress on it, per se, as a general question. But yes, I would say that if there was going to be a useful ontology in quantum mechanics, it would have to describe the branches at the least.
So when you say I'm not an ontology guy, correct me if I'm wrong, but you just gave a talk about beables, and I'm trying to put this together with the claim that you're not an ontology guy. So am I right in thinking that you are an ontology guy when it comes to kind of recovering macroscopic ontology, and you're not an ontology guy in the sense that you think the problem of recovering microscopic ontology is maybe, you know, harder than what you want to tackle? Have I parsed that correctly? Like it, normally, if somebody gives up and gives a whole talk about beables, then afterwards they would say, well, of course I'm an ontology guy. I just gave a whole talk about beables. Beables are a commitment to ontology.
But
so it's,
that,
again,
that,
it's surprising
that...
That would be
intellectual narrowness, Rob. You have to be able to hold many ideas in
my head. I'm happy holding many ideas. I just don't want the ideas to be contradicting one another. That's all. So
no, not at all. Especially if they're contradictory.
Oh, no.
Just contains multitudes.
Exactly. Not the first time it's been said.
Did you just admit that your views are contradictory, or?
I'm able to entertain contradictory views. I'm unsure which is correct. Even if you could show that they both can't be correct at the same time.
All right. Help me out.
Yeah.
you just gave a talk about beables, and you just said you're not an ontology guy.
Yeah.
How do I fit those two ideas together? Like, wait, just maybe
I
say
think,
more.
I think I may be using. The only thing I care about are. No, that's not correct. In this context, the thing that I'm really driving for is being able to take sloppy human intuitive language and distill it down to math.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an effective theory for measurements in a certain scale, and we can see this within a unitary quantum mechanical world. Would you agree with this? Is this true?
So I am optimistic that that you'll be able to define these things. It won't just be scale dependent. That you'll be able to define things.
Okay, but you cannot have things like agents measuring each other.
That's right.
Okay, so you restrict the set of observables that you think are, you have hoped to explain with this approach, and it excludes things like agents measuring each other. And in this particular case, they are local things.
Yeah, so
and that is your point.
Like,
no, I'm talking about the real world. It's not.
So right. So we can take the Scott Aronson approach and just say I'm not going to call anything an outcome unless it's guaranteed to be irreversible. And so with the agents measuring each other, there wasn't really a measurement. Just everything was just sort of in a classical looking superposition, and then it was reversed. And at the end of the day, it has to be fully maybe that requires you to be in some sort of certain expanding cosmology or something like that. Here's another way to think about it. What would you say that I'm, suppose, very, very optimistically on my part, that keeping track of branches allows you to do numerical simulations that you couldn't do before? And it also allows you to rewrite all the quantum textbooks in a way that empirically students are less irritated by them. Suppose you accomplish both of those things in my wildest dreams. Do I still have to say whether I'm doing ontology or not? Like have I made a mistake if I said that's not ontology?
Not necessarily, but I guess it's always useful to kind of know how to position your project in the kind of language that's familiar to people in quantum foundations. So, like, if somebody says to you, "Are you trying to innovate on the what the best interpretation of quantum theory is?" then it's kind of good to know. Like, it sounds to me from this discussion that you want to say something like, you're motivated to by something like quantum particle correspondence. Like, you know, we have this theory, quantum theory, which, if I understand you correctly, you know, we should think of in this kind of unitary, like, you know, take the system that's isolated, it evolves unitarily, that's quantum theory. Now you're dissatisfied with how the standard story about how you recover, for example, sequences of measurement outcomes and the probabilities of different correlations, right? Usually in the textbooks, they invoke some collapse postulate that refers to doing a measurement, but how you do a measurement is not described in terms of some sort of fundamental physical variables. And so you're saying, you know, you want to recover the operational predictions of quantum theory, kind of out of quantum theory in a different sort of way, that doesn't make any reference to measurement procedures as a primitive notion. And that's your main thing. And so maybe you want to say, so, you know, you're not really interpreting, you don't necessarily want an interpretation of what happens, you know, to some particles off in space that are evolving microscopically when nobody's looking at them, you know, what's going on there. A lot of people who want to interpret quantum mechanics want to say, I want to have a story about what's happening there, even when there are no measurements present. You could just say, no, that's not my project.
So I think that when we talk classically about the earlier part of the universe when no humans were around, we're like, we're talking about something that's sensible and real, and it's like, it's not just noise. I would like to know when we can do that and when we can't do that in a way that is precise. Whether or not those, you know, those are real or not, I think it's you can ask whether you have like a sample space that you can define classical probabilities on.
You want to sort of peg the meaningfulness of talking about something to the idea that there is a classical story there to be told.
No. The meaningfulness of talking classically about it.
Right.
I just want to figure out where that is. Like, I think we're doing something real when we talk about how the Earth was formed. That refers to reality and something real out there, some sort of ontology. But you can't do this arbitrarily far back, and you can't do it with weird projectors that don't correspond to ones, you know, histories that decohere or something like this. And right now, the borderline between that is fuzzy. We have extreme cases where we know that sort of talk is inconsistent, literally just leads to internal self-contradiction. And we have cases where it seems to be totally sensible and we think it refers to something real. I'd like to know where that boundary is. As far as that talk goes, if there is then further talk that you can do that is sensible, maybe, great. I just would like to erase the vagueness that currently exists.
So yeah, it sounds very much like you're about quantum classical correspondence. You want to say exactly what are the circumstances in which a classical description exists and I can tell a classical story, but you're open-minded about whether those are the only circumstances in which some story can be told about reality. Like you're saying, well, you know, it could be that there's situations where no classical story can be told, but there's nonetheless some ontological story that can be told, you know, because...
Yeah, I think that's
some underlying ontology.
That's Were you satisfied with this question about the trivial observables, like the...
Yeah, I guess I asked that question because I mistakenly thought that your project was to kind of provide an ontology for quantum theory. And if that was the project, then I think these sort of trivial observables would be a problem, because it would be a situation where you're like, nothing is... The ontological, like, suppose somebody came in and gave you the same talk but said, I'm proposing this as an ontological story.
Hold on a second.
Yeah, sorry.
The observables, if I wanted to make this an ontological story, the observables would not be the beables. The branches are the beables. And even if the only observables that are recorded are trivial ones, it would just mean the branch decomposition is trivial, but I could still say there's one branch, that is the beable. You have a sample space that's expanding in time because the number of branches is growing.
When you have your sample space, do you want to commit to like one element of that be true?
Maybe.
Like, if you're a many worlds person, then you would say that all of the branches exist, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm confused about that. I don't know how much of that is me being is something confusing about quantum mechanics. I don't know how much of it is just being confused about probability in general. Like if we had a fundamental stochastic theory, I think you can ask essentially the same question. Say you have a fundamental stochastic theory where you have a bunch of billiard balls bouncing around. It's a classical stochastic theory. When two billiard balls contact, there's some random bit that flips and they either do something or one way or the other. I could say that there is exactly one thing that happens and it's just the one I observe. Or I could say, well, in fact, they all happen. There's just some list somewhere of all possible outcomes. Now, the saying that just one thing happened in that classical case is more, is less problematic than in the quantum case. And it has to do with the fact that you can localize the stochastic event to a particular place. It has to do with the fact that, as I described it, the stochastic event is discrete, whereas branching is kind of the smooth, fuzzy thing, where it's harder to draw lines. But still, you have this same basic thing that anytime you have apparent stochasticity, indeterminism, you can either say all the things happened and I only have access to one, or only one is real and it's just pulled by God or something.
But
I kind of only remember the word vehicle kind of is supposed to commit you to thinking that there's only one. Like, I don't think there's many Bohmians that would say, like, oh yeah, you know, we define these positions and all possible positions are real.
I'm just using the words wrong. I just don't know how to use these words very well. So I would just, it's a classical sample space on which I can define a probability distribution.
Sample.
What's that?
Sample.
Sampleable. Yes. It's a sampleable. I'm totally happy with that.
But if you recovered a classical story, so classical probability over a sample space, then why not say one of these is the actual?
So if you take that as the fundamental theory, there's always this question of knowing that everything we know now is provisional. You're going to there's a possibility of learning stuff in the future. But if we just take that as the fundamental theory, we say this is as good as our physics knowledge is ever going to get. It seems like I'm not saying anything real. It's just like when people were talking about like angels on a pinhead or whatever these other classic philosophical examples where people had these discussions and then later we decided that what they were talking about was not real. I get the same creeped out feeling when somebody says they all happen and somebody else says only one of them happens and like everything is precise and there's no way to distinguish between those two things. I mean, there's like elegance criterion and like I'm happy using elegance criterion to say I don't think the moon dissolved last night and then rematerialized while I was asleep. Even though that, in principle, I can't rule that out. But at some point, when you have two options that both seem reasonably elegant, I don't know. I don't know how to distinguish between the two of them. It feels like something I can't make progress on.
Chris, if you're allowed to then recombine branches, right, to do these global measurements, and recombine branches, then you could distinguish the two cases, one where only one is real, and the other one where all of them is real, right? So if you force it to say that...
If the branches can recombine, then you can't define a classical probability distribution.
Sure, but you could say, well, for practical purposes, now we can define this classical probability distribution, but in principle, in the future, someone could come with this mega measurement and recombine them.
Yeah.
And if you commit now to only one of them being real, then you kind of say that that is not possible.
No, because you can say stuff like, you know, when again, this is kind of the Scott Aronson approach. Saying, when I say, okay, they've branched now, I'm implicitly assuming that I'm kind of like located myself within the block universe, right? But in fact, I can just consider the whole history of the universe. I can consider only branches that never ever recombine and say, maybe I don't really have access to that, but whatever the truth is set by, you know, the branches that don't ever recombine. That's what I refer to, and I can only just get good evidence that the branches will never recombine. In the same way that I, you know, get evidence that the universe is expanding and there's some sort of like irreversible thermodynamic event that happened, there will not be a Poincaré recurrence because the universe is expanding.
Does it concern you that normally when we say I've recovered a classical story, we're not merely saying, you know, the probability distribution that I would have assigned if it had been a classical reality and I had some incomplete knowledge of it evolves in this way. That's one way of recovering some element of our classical description. But typically when I say I have a classical description, I mean more than that. I mean, this is the description of my incomplete knowledge, but furthermore, there's a point underneath it all, which is obtaining and is evolving, and there's a distinction between what's going on in reality and what I merely know about it. So some might say, if you've only recovered, you know, the evolution of probability distributions, but you're still saying that there's no sense in which there's some single reality point in sample space underlying it, you haven't really recovered a classical story. You've just recovered sort of one part of the classical story and not the full classical story. So,
yeah. I think I'm just using shorthand. I think I'm just using shorthand when I say I recover a classical story. I just mean that I can give a precise classical description without making any statements about what's really going on underneath. I don't know. All of this seems I'm so uncertain that like quantum mechanics is correct. Right, that in 1,000 years we won't discover a million things that overturn it. That it's just like if you were, you know, in 1,000 BC and you were trying to decide, you know, ontology of rocks and this sort of thing. It just seems like you don't have enough information to know for sure what's at the bottom. So you kind of like do your best, and then when you get stuck, and you say, well, there's like two different ways you could go. Maybe I want to think about them really hard if I think I'm going to get new evidence or I'm going to be able to access something that would distinguish between the two. But insofar as I'm stuck, and I think I'm going to stay stuck for the next human lifetime, then I think I just have to say I'm limited, I don't know.
Sounds like you're endorsing operationalism, that to some extent you could say, well, as long as we can predict the outcomes of measurements and part, you know, you could say, well, part of having a correct operational interpretation is recovering the classical limit when we think classical physics applies. So what you're saying suggests to me that you're saying, well, I'm not really interested in the ontology project at all. I'm dissatisfied with the operational characterization of quantum theory because I don't think it generates the classical limit properly, and so I want
vague.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you want a sort of better operational characterization of the predictions of quantum theory that makes clear, for example, precisely when those operational predictions are in keeping with classical physics.
Again, I think this is the this is too grandiose, but it's a humble stance to say. There's at least two different possibilities, and I think my intuitive senses of elegance and my ability to philosophize and the observational evidence I'm going to have in my lifetime is unlikely to allow me to distinguish between these two cases. It doesn't mean there's not a fact of the matter. It also could be that I'm just confused and I'm like, I think there's a distinction when there actually is no distinction. I don't know, like what do you tell the guys in like 1000 BC who are arguing over the ontology of rocks? Like there's going to be a sense in which they're correct, and there's going to be like a deeper structure that they just have no hope of accessing. That's what I assume is like our situation now.
I guess I would say the fact that we can expect our best theories to be overthrown in the future doesn't mean we shouldn't try to, you know, do the best with the theories we have and understand the ontology of the theories we have today.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't see the fact that any theory is tentative as a good reason to dismiss the ontology project or say it's too early for the ontology project. We have to wait for the future to solve the ontology problem.
No. I think that.
So I would tell those guys, yeah, keep working on your ontology problem. You might get it wrong, but.
I would have some of them work on it, but if other ones said, I'm going to like start working on chemistry or something like that, and I am just going to be agnostic, not because I don't think it's worth knowing, but literally because I think I don't have access to the tools. I suspect I don't. I don't know if I don't have access to the tools, but I suspect I don't. It's like, there's like nothing wrong with that.
Irony there is that by virtue of working on chemistry, they'd be the first people in the world to really endorse the ontology project by discovering that the atomic hypothesis is what organizes everything in chemistry.
Right.
And they would show that people like Mach, who are strict operationalists, were clearly wrong.
Yeah.
Interesting feature of your example.
I don't think it is, right? The guys who were working on the chemistry actually advanced the ontological argument. Right? Those are the guys who would have advanced it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was disagreement among chemists.
Yeah.
There was those chemists who were strict operationalists and who said the business of chemistry is to calculate, you know, rates of reactions and, you know, what mass of distillate will I get, and any talk about some hypothetical atoms that are too small to see is all metaphysics and we should dismiss it.
I think you know me better than to think that I'm right.
Well,
dismissing this.
It's just you said, imagine those guys, they're trying to come up with the deontology of matter, but it's too soon, so he goes off and he does chemistry instead.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's an interesting example, because by, you know, if he wants to understand chemistry, he might be landed in you know, the only way he can do chemistry successfully and outcompete all the other chemists is by endorsing the ontology project and coming up with the idea that, hey, I think there's atoms, even though we can't see them. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's...
No, I think what you would do is you would see the two possibilities. There's atoms, there's not atoms, or something like this. You would consider the evidence, the best arguments you could come up with. You would say, you know, I'm unlikely to be able to get this exactly right by just thinking about it really hard. I think this is probably the more likely outcome, and maybe some people should be thinking about it hard, but otherwise I'm going to go work on something else while just keeping that in mind. I think we can make this like really even more concrete, right? We could, like, suppose we were trying to probe some new length scale in order to distinguish between different possible extensions of the standard model. Some people might go down one avenue which just for empirical reasons either will work or not work. And saying, I don't think that avenue is going to work for like specific engineering reasons does not mean you don't think it's a worthwhile thing to know. It just means in your best guess, that is not the approach.
Who are you with this analogy?
The guy who was saying we have to do, you know, that particular machine you're trying to build won't end up working. That's not how you're going to probe that smaller length scale in order to distinguish between those two different things. And he doesn't even have to say, I don't think anybody should work on that machine. He can just say, we're all picking the route that we think is most likely to be fruitful. Given the skills that each of us individually. I think we're on the same side, Rob.
Insofar as we've understood your
project. I got this strong impression you were taking this as like a criticism of the ontology project for anybody to do. I mean, it's just...
I guess I was more maybe trying to challenge you to not underestimate your ability to solve the ontology project. Like, let me put it this way, that suppose 99% of physicists had your opinion. Would that be good for physics? Would that be, you know, everybody saying, well, you know what, this ontology project, it's interesting, but it's too hard, and we're not really going to make progress. Let's, you know, people, smart people have thought about ontology, and they've made no progress, and quantum mechanics is confusing. Let's wait.
I'm the opposite of the opinion you're characterizing right now. I'm like, I've like specifically picked the thing that a lot of people have said is like a hopeless path, right? But I've been working on it alone for quite some time.
Well, I'm not saying that 99%, the hypothetical I was trying to entertain was not that, you know, 99% of physicists don't try to go their own idiosyncratic route, but just rather that this issue of, like, you know, I think it's clear now that your project is to sort of sort out in what circumstances does quantum theory go over to a classical description. And it seemed to me you were saying, and a question about ontology for microscopic systems that maybe don't have a classical story, that's a hard question. I think maybe it's too soon to solve that question. I'm personally not motivated to solve it.
I think I don't have the personal tools, having spent some time thinking about it.
Okay. And I'm saying, don't sell yourself short. I'm saying, I think it's a bad thing that scientists such as yourself, who I think does have the tools to address those questions, is saying, you know what, I don't want to tackle this because I don't have the right tools.
We have to ration our time and effort.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Some of us more than others. I don't know, it's just, you know, when we're deciding who gets the organs, right? It's not like we're saying, like, oh, those people not getting the organs aren't deserving. You know, it's just like triage.
What we say, give him a permanent job and then he can think of it.
That's right.
Can I ask a completely different question? So, in your example of the lattice, so correct me if I'm wrong, what you did was first you divided your Hilbert space into subsystems, this lattice points, right?
Yeah.
And you chose which factorizations you're interested in.
Yeah.
Then you took a state side.
Oh, no. I divided it into a microscopic factorization.
Yeah. Yes, true. Then you choose a state psi.
Yes.
And for this state psi, you go and try to find which observables and at what scale you can find this.
Yes.
This kind of classical correlations. Yes?
Yeah, if you fix a scale, then there is a unique decomposition of everything that's redundantly recorded.
And do you have any idea of how this goes? Say if now I change the state and I do a different state, or if there are families of states that all have the same, for which you always get the same kind of.
Are you talking about time evolution, or are you talking about?
I don't know. I'm trying to see how different this would be from state to state, or if you get some set of observables that.
Well, certainly. I mean,
that's the end. Like, you can apply to many.
Good. So it's totally going to depend on what the properties of the real world Hamiltonian are and what sorts of correlations it tends to generate. Again, the most kind of universal example I know of are these hydrodynamic systems. So it's come up in many different places. But in principle, I mean, you can construct a state to have kind of whatever correlations you want. So the question of like what correlations are out there, I don't know. All I know is that when I look around, like, I infer that the state of our world has certain correlations.
I'm just thinking because there's all this typicality results in thermalization.
Oh yeah, we're super not par random, right?
Yeah.
Good, it's good. This definitely relies on that we're in some really low entropy initial state. Yep. But like our ability to amplify, like making measurements even in a classical setting like relies on low entropy initial states. You can't have a measuring, a classical measuring device that is thermalized. I spent a significant amount of time trying to find a classical theory of measurement. If anybody had done that, like what is required, like sensitivity to initial conditions. This seems to be some sort of thing that's required, and like low entropy initial states, and nobody has written about it that I could find. I'm probably searching the wrong search terms.
That's nice, and that's something that makes it a bit more anthropocentric in a way, that you need to have this, say, this low entropy measurement device in order to achieve such a state.
Well, it doesn't have to be a device, right? Doesn't it like
state.
Well, so the pendulum is another bad example because it's also built by a person. But like the ocean is a hydrodynamic system, and it definitely started out in a non-equilibrium state. It's like a really special state that allows it to exhibit classical behavior. I would claim under my.
Oh, so you give me an example of that. So you could say humans evolved from the ocean, therefore like creatures that
like, if I made you a Harmonic state of the ocean, then there's nothing
right.
Classical going on in it, right? It's like time symmetric, and there are no beings, and there are no measuring devices, and there are no correlations, and that is almost all possible states of the ocean. We don't have to say anything about people. You know, one of the really big open questions is how much do the branches persist? How much do quadrants get erased? If they're only erased when subsystems thermalize, this seems like something you can handle because then again, for the reasons I described, you don't have to worry about it. But if they routinely unerase, if you basically expect to get Loschmidt echoes all the time, then this is like a major problem for this definition. They can't erase instantly. There's like, when you create long-range correlations, like, you know, if you start out in a product state on the lattice, creating a GHZ state on the lattice, like, you actually have to have enough time for things to propagate from one side to the other. And so likewise, undoing that is hard. There's also the, there's this interesting notion that if you, I can show that if you try to estimate local correlators, you can estimate them well by just sampling from branches. If you then allow the whole system to evolve into the far future when it thermalizes, then trivially I can also get a good estimate of the correlators by just sampling from the branches, because they're all R-random and they all just get the same thing. And so I'm kind of hopeful that kind of all through intermediate times, even kind of when they're in the process of erasing, they will continue to give a good estimate. And so there may be a useful notion of branches kind of even when they're halfway erased. But I really don't know how to move this about this stuff.
Now that I understand a bit better what you're doing, it does remind me a lot of some of the work on quantum Darwinism. So, you know.
100%. Yeah, I should have. Most of my talks I emphasize more. This time I was emphasizing Adrian Kent's work.
And in particular, the way Robin Blum talks about it, he has kind of the words he uses. I don't know exactly how Wojciech would say it. He would say something like, he wants to know when classical information theory is sufficient to describe a situation.
Yeah.
And then his criterion is that it's classical information theory if information gets encoded redundantly in the environment, something like that. All right, so he's using the word information, which kind of fits nicely with what you're doing, because in the beginning you emphasize that you're talking about probability distributions, so that's, you know, somebody's information, and you're trying to recover the classical evolution of those things, so essentially classical information theory. So I was just reminded of something. I don't quite have it, but when Robin talked about his stuff, it occurred to me that you could use some of the work coming out of categorical quantum mechanics in Oxford to try to make sense of, to try to go a bit deeper than some of Robin's analysis. So when you say something's copied into the environment, it's not clear exactly, like you're kind of relying, you're not saying this, but like when Robin were to say, okay, if information is copied into the environment, then it's classical information. So you're kind of relying on my intuitions about what copying is. I kind of know what copying is. We all understand what that word means. But if we're trying to sort of rederive classicality from a context where we don't have classicality, you know, so if I'm in a quantum context and somebody says, imagine you copy things into the environment, I might say, well, hang on, what do you mean by copying into the environment in a quantum context? But the people who do categorical quantum mechanics have a nice way of defining copying that is very abstract and doesn't refer to any classical intuition. So you've got a process that has one copy of a system, system coming in and two systems coming out. And you say, well, under what circumstances is that a copy operation? So you need a bit more structure. You say you've got a kind of ignoring operation, which acts on a system. You've got also a notion of an identity transformation. So one thing you can do is that a copy operation is something that if I do it and then I ignore one of the outcomes, that's the same as doing identity.
Yeah.
That's a really nice definition of copying, because I haven't relied on your classical intuitions at all. I just have very sparse structural elements. I've got a 1-2 map. I've got a notion of identity.
Yeah. Well, you have
it. It's the same as copying. Because if I trace out the bit that I flipped.
Well, you
should.
If you flip the bit, then I trace it out, it's not identity anymore, it's bit flip on the right. But
I need to be able to trace out both of them.
Yeah, they haven't given the full list, so you need to be able to trace out both of them. Also, if I copy and then copy again, it's the same thing as copying and copying again on the first guy, right? That doesn't make a difference as well. And then if you really, we could argue about what the right structural elements is, but you also have sort of upside down versions, 2-1 maps, and you could throw those in and demand something called the Frobenius law and say that's essential to copying. But the point is that I like the idea of taking the quantum Darwinism program and saying, and furthermore, you're not going to have to rely on your intuitions for understanding what we mean by copying information. I'm going to give that to you in a very abstract language, and it's just about structural features.
Yeah, that's what you mean by not relying on classical intuition. So I can
certainly
define what Robin means by a copy in a way where it's just like a statement about mutual information. Now, whether that is important or well-motivated, or whether in order to motivate it you need to rely on classical intuition, I think thinking about that to some extent is useful, but I am wary of like really being able to say, this definition doesn't rely on my classical intuition, but this one does. A lot of the times I feel like it's kind of like this intuition smuggling game. If I had a simple mathematical definition, I'd like a better handle on whether definition is simple or not than I do on whether it like is motivated in the absence of classical intuition. Maybe I have to see what you're talking about more, but like, you know, what Robin's talking about, although he may use sloppy language when he's talking to people, you can't express this as a statement about mutual information or a statement about like projectors and stuff like this, local projectors. you know, my opinion that the thing that is important about this that goes beyond what Wojciech and Robin worked on is that it doesn't require an arbitrary separation into to system and environment. It plausibly gives you an elegant principle for selecting a unit branch structure, or at least an approximation of the branch structure. And it's a little more exact. When you just say you have this, you know, you have a bunch of copies, it's like, well, if you have, Wojciech and Robin talked about this a little bit, but, you know, if you have, like, multiple observables that are like that, are they always mutually compatible, right? The place where you become really confident that you have a full and complete story is when, you know, you have one branch structure, you have all the observables that are eigenstates. Those branches are eigenstates. Another question for you, Rob. you agree, right, that there are cases in the past where people have been having philosophical discussions and they were just confused. And they were talking about a discussion that didn't exist. And you also agree that there were cases where they were having a discussion about something that was like, it was like a real dispute about which there was like a good answer, yes or no, with one person on each side, but they just didn't have access to a good way to adjudicate that at the time and had to wait. Like, so those cases exist, right? Okay. That's all. So it's just, then what we would really need is like a principle for like, you know, how do we distinguish between the case where we're stuck and we should try a different approach and the case where more work is useful. To some extent, it's just going to be a professional opinion.
Relates back to the earlier conversation, I presume.
Yes. As I said, I really feel like, in the grand scheme of physics, I am 99.9% in agreement with you compared to the rest of the world. I'm very happy to say different people should work on different things, and simultaneously say, on the whole, a bunch of other people are making a mistake. They have put all their eggs in one basket where they have, you know, even if this question doesn't deserve, you know, the vast majority of everyone's attention, it deserves 10% of the field's attention, and it gets an infinitesimal fraction of the field's attention. And like that, I would like definitely endorse.
So maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, but what I heard in it was a kind of notion that it's too soon to solve these kinds of problems, in your opinion. Is that something like that?
I've spent time thinking about them,
yeah.
And I have gotten
right.
Stuck, me personally.
Right. I think all I wanted to say is that I worry a little bit about the fact that so many people, I do hear a kind of similar statement. Like, I do hear a lot of people saying, I'm interested in these problems, but I don't think I have the tools to solve them. I don't think I have the right aptitude. I don't know where to begin, and so on. And maybe in many cases they have not. In some cases they have. And it concerns me. Like I'll give you an example. Howard Wiseman, he's a really smart guy. And he's thought a lot about interpretations of quantum. But when I push him on various kind of deep questions, he often kind of retreats into, oh, that problem's too ambitious. I'm not interested in it. And it worries me that smart guys take that as a cop-out, like, oh, that's too ambitious, I'm gonna back away from that question.
I'm not interested in that. Like, that's a kind of, quite a negative way to say, boy, that looks hard, I don't know how to do that.
Sure.
Which to me strikes me as like an appropriately humble response to it.
Do you want to continue the discussion at the bistro downstairs?
Food time?
Yes. Why don't we just stop discussing? We could just continue there while we're food. I'm only
happy. Humility is a good thing, I agree, but too much humility can...
I just don't think most of the time people aren't being humble. They're just... People don't know why they work on what they work on. I mean, they work on what they work on because somebody who is high status or prestigious or something like this works on it. They haven't thought carefully about what the important open questions are. And when they're confronted with somebody who says, you should work on this different question, they haven't thought about it enough. They don't know how to assess it. They're gonna keep doing what they're doing. And so they just say, it seems too hard, I'm not gonna try. And they're wimps. I'm like totally happy to say that. At the same time, that doesn't mean that can't be the right answer. You know what I mean? It's just like if somebody can give up trying to build a machine because they wimped out, or they can give up because it's the prudent thing to do with the information they have at hand. And of course, the people who are wimping out are going to say it's because it's the prudent thing to do, because they don't want to admit that they wimped out or they hadn't thought about it hard. Yeah.
So would you agree that as a community,
physicists
have wimped out of the hard problem of understanding the ontology of quantum theory prematurely and unjustifiably?
Absolutely.
Good. All right, we're in agreement. So everybody should work harder on the ontology problem and not assess it as, you know, not the right time to solve this problem and too hard and we should postpone it to later and so forth. You know, we should as a community, maybe not as, you know, a particular individual, it's a different question, but as a community, we should work harder on solving this problem.
Well, why do you think I'm here? Why am I in this building?
Good, but I did detect from you a kind of, you're not interested in the ontology project per se. You have this project about classical quantum correspondence, and you're, and I grant that's a great project, but I'm really talking about the ontology project now, like, and that we shouldn't wimp out on the ontology project. So are we agreeing on that as well?
Again, I think we just have like different professional assessments of how optimistic we should be about them.
Right.
They are colored by our personal abilities. They're not.
There's a lot of difference in personal abilities in the community or between you and I. It's maybe just an assessment of how likely we are to make progress on that particular problem.
Oh, really? I think there's like lots of people who are terrible at thinking about those sorts of questions, either because they don't like it or maybe they're not doing it.
People decide for themselves, you know what, I'm terrible at thinking about ontology, so I'm not going to do it. Do you think they reflect that way about...
No. I think they...
Most people who don't work on it are like, oh no, I read a soundbite about Popper and realized that all that is just baloney metaphysics. And that's why I don't work on it.
I have a very cynical view that I think that once you stop having empirical feedback in the field, we have these much worse mechanisms for assessing people that has to do with number of papers and like how impressive the papers seem. That you can have a whole field of people that all convince themselves that they're working on something important, even if they're working on like incredible minutiae and putting huge amounts of time into it. So, and they just do that because they want the job more than they want to answer the important questions.
Because they need a job, they don't need to answer questions.
What's that?
Because they need a job to answer questions.
No, but if that were the case, then as soon as they got a permanent job, they would like to switch over, and they never do.
That's why they do, right?
No, they do not.
Sometimes they do.
Mm.
I think it's extremely rare. I think if you go to most of the physicists once they get tenured positions, like if they had to like go back and convince their like 23-year-old selves entering grad school that this was what they were going to spend the time working on, like I don't think they could get excited about it.
And with this optimistic take.